Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 7th, 2003. Today's session is a poetry reading presented by Maury Wee and Kai Carlson Wee. The number is WEM2003-01. Let's listen in.
Would that be all right if that's a podcast? Sounds like a nice idea. We sit in a circle around the farm. There's a better chance you'll all hear that way. Okay. Burn it, Bob. That's our signal that the media people are recording us. And I'm Maury Wee, and this is...
I'm Kai Carlson Wee, son of Morse.
When we just wanted to share some poems with you. We didn't seem to have people doing poetry in the village this week. Often we do. And so I was recruited as a former teacher of poetry. I'm a pastor in a suburb of Minneapolis. Kai is more engaged with poetry these days as a student and a writer. But I used to teach literature, and so I've got a lot of poems that I love. We thought, though, that this time it's a sign that you've been married a long time when you do this, but this Christmas, one of the hot books at the bookstore was a collection by Garrison Keillor, a collection of poems that he reads on Writer's Almanac, which is something I'd like to listen to when I get a chance. And I gave a copy of this to my wife, Christine Carlson, and she gave a copy to me. and our friends said, "You've been married for a long time." They didn't say too long. but one of the reasons I brought this along, because I've been working my way through this book, and it's the only collection of poems I have along, so it made some sense to me to choose poems from this book, even though we have a good library here. Kai and I, in the end, chose a few other poems too, but most of ours are coming from this book. And one reason I think that probably works all right is that Keillor chooses poems that he can read on the air, and people listening on the air can get it without having a lot of interpretation and without having it reread or having to look at it in print. And so maybe it'll work well for us too. It also means that these are poems that aren't old saws in English classes, and most of these poems I've never seen before the last 6 months. So maybe they'll be fresher for me to read, and maybe they'll be fresh for you to hear. A couple of you came in later. Do any of you have poems to read with you that you would like to read?
No.
Okay. I think that if you've got a comment or a question about any of these poems, just come out with it. I know it's not, it kind of runs against the style of poetry readings to talk about the poems at all. Particularly anybody else besides the person reading, but if you've got something to say, or especially a question, like what was that line, or you know, by all means, just bring it up. We're a small enough group, we can do it. And I've got these poems organized in my own head in four categories. And the first one is poems somehow about the creation. And that's where we're going to start. So why don't you read, here's my order, when I heard the learning, why don't you read that one first?
Right. This is a poem by Walt Whitman, and It's a poem that is short, so it's good for reading, but it's also about the wonder of the world, and it's about not having to always classify and get technical with everything, and just being in awe of everything is good enough sometimes. It's called When I Heard the Learned Astronomer. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer, where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountably, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time, looked up in perfect silence at the stars.
I suppose the famous poet of the creation, American poet, is Frost, the one we've all read a lot of. And so I'm going to read a couple of Frost poems. And these are kind of old favorites, I suppose. This first one is called Nothing Gold Can Stay. And it's because of this poem that I noticed for the first time that when the trees bud in the spring, they come out with gold buds that turn into green leaves. Don't know why I hadn't noticed that before. Nothing gold can stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. The next one by Frost I want to read is called Neither Out Far Nor In Deep. The people along the sand all turn and look one way. They turn their back on the land. They look at the sea all day. As long as it takes to pass, a ship keeps raising its hull. The winter ground, like glass, reflects a standing gull. The land may vary more, but wherever the truth may be, the water comes ashore and the people look at the sea. They cannot look out far. They cannot look in deep. But when was that ever a bar to any watch they keep? One of the things I was really surprised about when I studied Frost was how much ironic poetry he wrote, including The Road Not Taken, his most famous poem. I won't say more about that. We'll talk about that some other time. But a lot of his poetry takes a kind of ironic approach to things. And he was a student and a lover of the creation, but he had a distinct sense of the limits of our connectedness. And that's the theme of this next poem I'm going to read called Come In. And it's this gentle sense of the way we think being different from, in this case, a thrush. Come in. As I came to the edge of the woods, thrush music, hark. Now if it was dusk outside, inside it was dark, too dark in the woods for a bird by sleight of wing to better its perch for the night, though it still could sing. The last of the light of the sun that had died in the west still lived for one song more in a thrush's breast. Far in the pillared dark, thrush music went, almost like a call to come into the dark and lament. But no, I was out for stars. I would not come in. I meant not, even if asked, and I hadn't been. This next poem is by Liesl Mueller, When I Am Asked. This is a spectacular poem. When I am asked how I began writing poems, I talk about the indifference of nature. It was soon after my mother died, a brilliant June day, everything blooming. I sat on a gray stone bench in a lovingly planted garden, but the daylilies were as deaf as the ears of drunken sleepers, and the roses curved inward. Nothing was black or broken, and not a leaf fell, and the sun blared endless commercials for summer holidays. I sat on a gray stone bench, ringed with the ingenue faces of pink and white impatience, and placed my grief in the mouth of language, the only thing that would grieve with me.
What's the first name?
Liesl.
Liesl.
Yeah, L-I-S-E-L. And the Mueller is M-U-E-L-L-E-R. All right. I forgot the poem I was going to read for an introduction. Should I do that now? I can't remember what I was going to say about it either, but I kind of liked it, and it didn't fit any of my categories. Just, it was kind of a thought about the audience of poems. This is called Poem to be Read at 3 a.m. Accepting the diner on the outskirts, the town of Ladora at 3 a.m. was dark, but for my headlights. And up in one second-story room, a single light where someone was sick or perhaps reading as I drove past at 70, not thinking. This poem is for whoever had the light on. All right, a couple of poems about work.
Doing work in the community, and so it's kind of relevant to Holden. But I think it's also about commitment to one another and commitment to yourself and being part of the community. Kind of. It's called To Be of Use by Marge Percy. The people I love the best jump into work headfirst without dallying in the shallows, and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real.
This one's called Soybeans, by Thomas Allen Orr. The October air was warm and musky, blowing over brown fields, heavy with the fragrance of freshly combined beans, the breath of harvest. He was pulling a truckload onto the scales at the elevator near the rail siding north of town when a big Cadillac drove up. A man stepped out, wearing a three-piece suit and a gold pinky ring. The man said he had just invested $100,000 in soybeans and wanted to see what they looked like. The farmer stared at the man and was quiet, reaching for the tobacco in the rear pocket of his jeans, where he wore his only ring, a threadbare circle rubbed by working cans of dip and long hours on the backside of a 100-acre run. He scooped up a handful of small white beans, the pearls of the prairie, saying, "Soybeans look like a foot of water on the field in April when you're ready to plant and can't get in. Like three kids at the kitchen table eating macaroni and cheese 5 nights in a row. Or like a broken part on the combine when your credit with the implement dealer is nearly tapped. Soybeans look like prayers bouncing off the ceiling when prices on the Chicago grain market start to drop. Or like your old man's tears when you tell him how much the land might bring for subdivisions. Soybeans look like the first good night of sleep in weeks when you unload at the elevator and the kids get Christmas." He spat a little juice on the tire of the Cadillac, laughing despite himself, and saying to the man, "Now maybe you can tell me what $100,000 looks like."
What is the title then?
Soybeans.
Just called Soybeans.
Soybeans, and the author is Thomas Orr, O-R-R. And this next one, in the same vein as the other two, called Oxcart Man by Donald Hall. In October of the year, he counts potatoes dug from the brown field, counting the seed, counting the seller's portion out, and bags the rest on the cart's floor. He packs wool sheared in April, honey and combs, linen, leather tanned from deer hide, and vinegar in a barrel hooped by hand at the forge's fire. He walks by his ox's head 10 days to Portsmouth Market and sells potatoes and the bag that carried potatoes, flaxseed, birch brooms, maple sugar, goose feathers, yarn. When the cart is empty, he sells the cart. When the cart is sold, he sells the ox, harness, and yoke, and walks home, his pockets heavy with the year's coin for salt and taxes. And at home by fire's light in November cold, stitches new harness for next year's ox in the barn, and carves the yoke and saws planks, building the cart again.
It's been made into a children's book.
Really? Yeah. I've never seen that poem before. Although Donald Hall has been writing poems for a long time, great poet. All right. The next, yeah, I said the doors would be left open for easy escape, and I lied. The next three poems are love poems, and it's Garrison, it's surprising, does not do much with love poems in here. So these are kind of unusual. One old-fashioned one, one a modern, looking back at an old-fashioned poem. At any rate, here they are. Venetian Air by Thomas More. This is the old one. Row gently here, my gondolier, so softly wake the tide, that not an ear on earth may hear, but hers to whom we glide. Had heaven but tongues to speak, as well as starry eyes to see, oh, think what tales 'twould have to tell of wandering youths like me. Now rest thee here, my gondolier, hush, hush, for up I go to climb yon light balcony's height while thou keep'st watch below. Ah, did we take for heaven above but half such pains as we take day and night for woman's love, what angels we should be. Maybe the sentences are a little bit long to follow. It's the kind of poems they used to write all the time. This next one, right away, has a more contemporary feel to it. At 23 weeks, she can no longer see anything south of her belly, by Tom Ward. I'm painting my wife's toes in Revlon Supercolor 49. I have no idea what I'm doing. She asked me to get the bottle, then crashed on her bed, muscle sore, pelvis aching. Lifting the brush, I skim the excess polish across the glass, daub a smidgen on her nail, push it out in streaks over the perfect surface to the cuticle's edge. I'm painting my wife's toes. I have no idea what I'm doing. The smell of fresh enamel intoxicates. Each nail I glaze is a tulip, a lobster, a scarlet room where women sit and talk, their sleek, tinctured fingers sparking the air.
It's quite a contrast between those two.
Yeah.
Chosen, actually.
And this one is kind of an interesting perspective on the history of romance. It's called Romantics, subtitled Johannes Brahms and Clara Schumann by Liesel Müller, who we've heard from already. The modern biographers worry how far it went, their tender friendship. They wonder just what it means when he writes he thinks of her constantly, his guardian angel, beloved friend. The modern biographers ask the rude, irrelevant question of our age, as if the event of two bodies meshing together establishes the degree of love, forgetting how softly Eros walked in the 19th century, how a hand held over long or a gaze anchored in someone's eyes could unseat a heart, and nuances of a dress not known in our egalitarian language could make the redolent air tremble and shimmer with the heat of possibility. Each time I hear the intermezzi, sad and lavish in their tenderness, I imagine the two of them sitting in a garden among late blooming roses and dark cascades of leaves, letting the landscape speak for them, leaving us nothing to overhear. I think that's a very interesting poem about how our imaginations work. Don't know. The last series of poems I'm going to read, so we're getting there, it's a longer series than the other three, but they're all about, in some way, mortality. And it struck me how many of the poems in this collection were that. One of the things that I discovered reading and teaching poems for a while is that because poetry is done in solitary, there's a lot of poetry that's inward-looking. And there's very little poetry that really works that's about parties. You know, it's just a solitary enterprise. And so you end up with a lot of reflection about mortality. And so these last poems are about that. I'm just going to read other words.
The poem is called Otherwise. Kid, I really like this poem. By Jane Kenyon. I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood. All morning I did the work I love. At noon I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know, it will be otherwise.
Jane Kenyon was married to Donald Hall and died young of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
This poem is by Kenneth Rexroth, called Another Spring. The seasons revolve and the years change with no assistance or supervision. The moon, without taking thought, moves in its cycle, full, crescent, and full. The white moon enters the heart of the river. The air is drugged with azalea blossoms. Deep in the night, a pine cone falls. Our campfire dies out in the empty mountains. The sharp stars flicker in the tremulous branches. The lake is black, bottomless in the crystalline night. High in the sky, the northern crown is cut in half by the dim summit of a snow peak. Oh, heart, heart, so singularly intransigent and corruptible. Here we lie entranced by the starlit water, and moments that should each last forever slide unconsciously by us like water. It's one of the mysteries of life that there are these kind of timeless moments and you can't hang on to them. They ought to last forever. This next poem is kind of in the form of a blessing by Sheena, is that how you say that name? Sheena Pugh? Irish name? S-H-E-E-N-A-G-H. Anybody know how to pronounce that?
N-E what?
S-H-E-E-N-A-G-H. Sheena? What did you say? Well, we'll try that. Just say things with authority and people will believe you. This poem is called Sometimes. Sometimes things don't go, after all, from bad to worse. Some years, muscadel faces down frost. Green thrives. The crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. A people sometimes will step back from war, elect an honest man, decide they care enough that they can't leave some stranger poor. Some men become what they were born for. Sometimes our best efforts do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen for you.
How do you spell the
P-U-G-H. The easiest thing is just get a hold of this book and then they're all in here.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. This next one is by the poet laureate of the United States, Billy Collins. I think there was a Billy Collins reading here not very long ago, or a bunch of his poems.
There was at New Year's.
And New Year's. Oh, yeah, was he out here by New Year's?
No,
he did one recently, too. Yeah, okay. Billy Collins came to Minneapolis not very long ago. I got to hear him read. He's a very appealing man. Mm-hmm. He makes you want to read and write poetry. Anyway, this one's called Passengers. At the gate, I sit in a row of blue seats with the possible company of my death. This sprawling miscellany of people, excuse me, let me back up. At the gate, I sit in a row of blue seats with the possible company of my death, this sprawling miscellany of people. Carry-on bags and paperbacks that could be gathered in a flash into a band of pilgrims on the last open road. Not that I think if our plane crumpled into a mountain, we would all ascend together, holding hands like a ring of skydivers, into a sudden gasp of brightness, or that there would be some common place for us to reunite to jubilize the moment, some spaceless, pillarless Greece, where we could, at the count of three, toss our ashes into the sunny air. It's just that the way that man has his briefcase so carefully arranged, the way that girl is cooling her tea, and the flow of the comb that woman passes through her daughter's hair. And when you consider the altitude, the secret parts of the engines,
and all the hard water in the deep canyons below. Well, I just think it would be good if one of us maybe stood up and said a few words, or so as not to involve the police, at least quietly wrote something down. This next one is called Authorship. It's by James Naylor. King David and King Solomon led merry, merry lives with many, many lady friends and many, many wives. But when old age crept over them with many, many qualms, King Solomon wrote the Proverbs and King David wrote the Psalms. Two more poems. This next one is called, well, it's by W.S. Merwin, and it's called For the Anniversary of My Death. Every year, without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me, and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star. Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth and the love of one woman and the shamelessness of men, as today, writing after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease, and bowing, not knowing to what. This last poem I'm going to read is also by Jane Kenyon, who wrote Otherwise. And it's been an important poem in our family because we have a poet in our family, my niece Rebecca, who has been here at Hold a number of times. And she had a husband, Michael, who died of cancer. And during the time that he was sick with leukemia, this poem by Jane Kenyon, who, as I mentioned earlier, also died of cancer, became very important to them. Let evening come. Let the light of late afternoon shine through the chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the crickets take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to air in the lung, let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless, so let evening come. That's our collection of poems for today.
I had the privilege of taking a class with Rebecca here June before last when she was here. Mm-hmm. It's so remarkable, I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
Does she still have a book or two? And do you know?
I'm not sure.
Her book is in the library.
Yeah.
In the library.
This year, since we're talking about Rebecca, she somewhat out of the blue. I don't quite know to what extent she had to apply for this, but I think she was selected without actually applying for a major national poetry award. Mm-hmm. That was, and she was selected by Billy Collins. Mm-hmm. So she got to go out to Washington, D.C. and read her poems in the Library of Congress and be presented with this award by Billy Collins.
And so that was a real treat and an honor for her.
What is your last name, Rebecca?
Wee. And we had hoped that she could come out this month, too. I had the privilege of attending her sessions, I guess, was it 2 years ago now or 1 year? Might have been.
She, when I took it, it was June, this is June, two years ago.
Yeah, it might have been, that might have been when I was here with her, too.
2001.
Well, thanks for your listening.
Thank you.
If you find good poems, I'd love to see them.